So we have a very intimate lecture today. So today we discuss a very important problem in condensed matter theory, and that it has also fundamental implications, and it's the role of locality. The role of locality in condensed matter theory. So the first thing, so let's review very briefly what we understood from the study of the X, Y, and or quantumizing model. So we saw that we have two phases, okay? A disordered phase. The paramagnet, where the ground state is unique, there is no local order parameter, so it is disordered. And connected correlation functions. So now I write with sigma z, but any connected correlation functions connected. So you remember it is in the ground state. It is just this. Decay exponentially. And you have seen that these quantities are related, the correlation length. On the other hand, in the ordered phase, in the ferromagnetic phase, the ground state is degenerate. We have spontaneous magnetization, so there is a local order parameter. So that's why it's called ordered. And now let's look at the correlation functions. Okay. So the ground state is degenerate, so we have something like this. We still have a gap above the ground state. So the precise mathematical statement is that there is a basis such that, so there is a psi 1, psi 2 that are a basis in the ground state, in the ground space, such that the connected correlation function so sigma z connected in either of these states do not decay exponentially. So you have explicitly computed that. So this is the precise mathematical statement. However, usually in literature, people, so we call this long range order, okay? However, usually people don't care too much about the difference Well, it depends. Sometimes they care, sometimes they don't. But sometimes we don't care about the difference between connected and non-connected correlation functions. So if we relax this difference, then actually in every basis this happens. Okay? So also in the symmetry breaking basis, we have long range order. Although now what is not decaying is not the connected correlation functions, but the simple correlation functions. So to in the state all spins up, the connected correlation functions are zero, or wherever just the correlation functions are finite, and sometimes people still call this long range order. Okay? So you see that the behavior of the connected correlation functions distinguishes between the symmetry breaking states and the non-symmetry breaking states. And we like to keep this distinction in mind. In fact, we see that if we focus our attention on the connected correlation functions, and we consider operators that do not connect the two ground states, then also these correlation functions decay exponentially, the connected one, for instance, in psi up, exp decay. So you remember that the difference between a symmetry breaking state and the Schrödinger's cat is that the Schrödinger's cat, there are always operators that connect them, local operators that connect them. So because there are always operators that connect them, you do have long-range connected correlation functions. However, if they are disconnected in the operators that you are considering, so like psi up, so sigma z does not connect psi up with psi down, or even sigma x does not connect psi up with psi down because we need a long string to do that, then in this basis we would see exponential decay. So psi up is what I defined, all spins up.
You mean so you're averaging over the state with all spins up?
It's the expectation value on this state.
Okay.
So this is a notation that we've used already before. Okay. So now this is just a review of things that we've seen, okay? But now let's ask some questions. Okay. So first of all, we see that every time the ground state is unique, or if I can consider it unique, like when I consider operators, correlation functions of operators that do not connect different ground states, so I don't know that there is another ground state, then I have exponential decay. Okay? So if the ground state is unique and I have a gap, I have exponential decay of correlation functions. And also, when I have this other situation that is described here, but then, so this situation is more complicated in the sense that one has to be very precise what you mean, and it's, well, you still have, you can still say, okay, however, there is some basis in which I do have a long-range order always, right? So our statement that we have really to remember is that if the ground state is unique and we have a gap, then we have exponential decay. Now we have two questions. The first one is a question that we already asked, and is the other implication possible. I mean, does it hold? Every time we have exponential decay, then we have a unique ground state. Or is it possible to have a ground state that is degenerate and still have exponential decay? So here we see that in the case of the symmetry breaking that this can be true only for some operators, for those operators that do not connect them. But every time there is symmetry breaking, there is an order parameter. The order parameter connects some of the states by definition of order parameter. So in some sense, the answer to this question, so the structure of what is the structure of correlation functions is also the answer to our question, do we have types of orderings that go beyond symmetry breaking? Okay, so this is the first question. The second question is, okay, we have computed this fact, okay, the exponential decay of correlation functions in the quantumizing model, in the XY model, so we know it happens. But let's stop for a second and ask, do you find this thing, you know, do you find it surprising in some way or not? I mean, it's the result of a calculation, so maybe every time we see the result of a calculation, we stop being surprised. So but let me show you that this should be surprising. And so this introduces our topic of today, that is locality. Locality in quantum many body theory. Quantum many mechanics. Yep.
What do you refer to as the local order parameter?
Sigma z, the magnetic tension. In the quantumizing model, it's sigma z. So, in every symmetry breaking, there is a local order parameter that is this, the value of its. The expectation value of some operator that breaks the symmetry, that spontaneously acquires an expectation value that is different from zero. Whereas if you take the expectation value in the symmetric state, it would be zero, right? When we have all spins up plus all spins down, the average magnetization in this state is zero. But because there is spontaneous symmetry breaking, then I am stuck in one of the two sectors, and the spontaneous magnetization, the magnetization acquires spontaneously a value that is different from zero, that is either plus one or minus one. So this is this is also a classical phenomenon. In quantum mechanics, this phenomenon is much more complicated because it's not clear. So while in classical statistical mechanics, it's very clear why we are not in a mixture of all spins up and all spins down. In quantum mechanics, mathematically, we could be in the symmetric superposition of all spins up and all spins down. And to say that this doesn't happen, we have to show, like I argued with the sketched proof, that these states are not stable. Okay? But you need, so you have stability against something, right? Like against fluctuations, against environment, against, or otherwise mathematically, the statement of symmetry breaking is a boring statement. It just says that there is a basis that breaks the symmetry, which by itself, it's not very significant. So the physical content of it is given by this stability argument.
Why are you looking at the connected
relationship function, not just the relationship? I mean, specifically because they have this property. Because they have the property that every time the ground state is unique, we can assume this. And when the ground state is degenerate, it's the connected correlation functions that show you the difference between different bases. Okay. So it's specifically for this reason. And at this, right now, we know this result as the result of a direct calculation in a specific model. Okay? And at the end of tomorrow's lecture, we'll show that this behavior is true in general. But now let me try to make you surprised about this result. Okay? So this is a locality result. So we are saying every time the ground state is unique, there is no way that far apart degrees of freedom can be correlated. He says, yeah, so what? why that should be surprising? Okay, so let me show that. You that it should be surprising. Because locality in quantum, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we are in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, at first sight should be surprising. In fact, let me convince you of this. Imagine that I have a big system, and I have some degrees of freedom that are in A, some degrees of freedom that are in B, the rest I call it C. Okay? So these are separated by a large distance. And imagine that ours is what we defined a generalized spin system, okay? So let me spell out again what is the definition. It means that our total Hilbert space is the tensor product of local Hilbert spaces at each point, that the dimension of this thing is finite, that we consider bosonic operators . This means that if two operators have a disjoint support, then they must commute, just like spin operators do. And also we require that they are up, that they are bounded, so that they're bounded from below, but also from above. And the Hamiltonian of our system is the sum of local operators. So let me call the max of all these interactions. Let me call it just phi. And the diameter of x is upper bounded by r, and the volume of x is upper bounded by sigma. Okay. So this is our definition. So obviously, so let's take an operator that has support in A, and so allow me sometimes to use the same notation for the operator and the support. Okay, it's clear if I'm talking about operators or sets. So let's take operator A and B with supports in A and B. Okay, so what is their commutator? Zero, right? They're apart. They're disjoint support, so their commutator is zero. So roughly speaking, we will prove this rigorously. This means that If I do some operation here, and then no measurement done in B can see it. Okay. But now let's be in a state that evolves in time. Okay. So A also will evolve in time because I can use the Schrödinger picture to evolve the Heisenberg picture to evolve operators. And now let me ask you, what is the commutator between A of t and B? And I want to know if it's zero or not.
Phi is smaller than?
Phi. Some number phi.
What about x smaller than?
R.
The next one, sorry?
This is the volume of x.
Oh, okay.
How many points there are in x? I'm saying that at most there are sigma points in x.
Okay.
So for instance, in the axiom model, sigma is 2. At most, in my Hamiltonian, I have two body couplings, right? And they are at most at distance 1. So the diameter is, and then, you know.
And just to make sure where you wrote x, how do you call it?
Intersection.
Y is, that's not phi, that's 0.
Oh, this is the empty set. So let's use another.
No, it's
okay. Let me call it k. There are too few Greek and Latin letters.
Okay, so what is this commutator? Now, for A of t, is it zero or not?
Not necessarily.
Oh, sorry?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. In fact, generically not.
Yeah, but,
why not?
Sorry, but if we evolve A, then we should evolve B as well. Yes.
But I'm asking you to evaluate A of T computed for B.
So different times.
Sure. I mean, I can also do... I just get something more complicated, but I'm asking you to evaluate this quantity. Okay. The reason why I asked you to evaluate this quantity is because it is... In the end, I will still be interested in making measurements only in B.
So tomorrow when we see the applications we will prove today, you will see that this is actually the quantity that we need to prove all we want to prove, okay? So, but now just this, so this is what we need. So as your colleague said, this is different from zero, but why? Why it's different from zero?
Loud, please.
Well, the Hamiltonian could evolve A into the support of B.
Yeah, exactly. So the Hamiltonian, even if it's the sum of local operators, so every element of the sum has support only in X, but the support of the whole H is the whole lattice. Moreover, the exponentiation of the Hamiltonian, it's even worse, and it has definitely support everywhere. So A of T has support everywhere.
And it's a very complicated operator that unless we pick some specific B that has some symmetry in common with the symmetries of the Hamiltonian, then we might have some conserved quantity and could by chance happen that this commutator is zero. What?
The commutator will be zero if we take A and B at the same time.
No. No. No, it's not.
If B evolves by the same law as A.
No, just not. It's too complicated operators.
No, why? IHT will cancel out with E plus IHT.
Are you saying that E? First of all, let me see it again. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so but again, I don't care about that quantity. This is the quantity we need. Okay? This is the quantity we need in order to prove the statement that if I make an operation in A, I want to see after how much time I can read out this operation in B. So this is the quantity that we will need for this, to see whether I can signal from A to B.
And so tomorrow we'll see that this is the quantity that we see. And the result, what we see tomorrow, is that if this quantity is different from zero, then I can see in B the effect of what I did in A. Okay? So, but this is different from zero for every t. No matter how small t is and how large is the distance between A and B. So this means that I can immediately signal from A to B, which is we don't like, right? We don't like signaling at infinite speed. Well, so you might just shrug it off and say, yeah, you know what? It's not relativistic quantum mechanics. That's why it happens. There is no light cone. Okay. Things can communicate far apart at infinite speed. It's not the right theory. So this, of course, this is a correct answer. But now you should be surprised about this. Because if it's true that we can, every degree of freedom can talk with every other degree of freedom, regardless of how small is the time or the distance or the interplay between the two, then why do we find this thing? Why do we find the clustering of correlation functions? Serves you as a motivation. Of course, you can argue, but wait a second, here these are correlation functions at different time, here they are at equal time and just distance. But we will see at the end that these two things are very connected. In fact, if this doesn't happen, if this is different from zero, also the correlation functions must be different from zero. Well, so to be sure, in fact, they're not exactly zero. They're exponentially small. So in the thermodynamic limiter for any extended system, this means that for all practical purposes, they're zero. So maybe this is what's happening here too. Maybe, yeah, it's not zero, but it's zero for all practical purposes. But if it were so, this is great. I mean, this is very interesting. We would be saying that there is a light cone in non-relativistic quantum mechanics that is kind of fuzzy, meaning I can, in fact, send a signal between here and here, but this signal, for all practical purposes, is zero. So it's not a sharp light cone like in relativistic quantum mechanics, in which you impose in the structure of the theory that it must have a Lorentz symmetry. Here we do not have this symmetry at all, but we are saying, I am claiming that that fact is telling somehow us that these commutators are very small. For all practical purposes, are zero when A is here, A of T is here, and B is here. Okay, so this is all words, but we need to show it. And the way to show it is a theorem by Lieber-Robinson called the Lieber-Robinson bounds that I will go on to prove now. Okay, Lieber-Robinson bounds. So let me call this commutator, let me call it f of t. Okay? And my goal is to make an upper bound to the norm of this commutator, because in the end I want to say that it's almost zero. Okay? So I'm concerned with finding an upper bound to this. Very well. So to do that, we will use a number of tricks. Okay. So first of all, let me take the first derivative of f. So you know that to take derivatives of time-evolving operators, it's like commuting them with the Hamiltonian. Okay. So I can just write this derivative as a of t commutator h commutator. And there is a minus psi. Sorry. So this is like the Schrödinger equation for this operator, for this commutator. So in the following, I will make a certain number of these mistakes. But the reason why it doesn't matter is that in the end, I take the norm. So all these faces don't. But in the notes, they're fine, OK? There will not be. All right, OK. So now what we want to use is the fact that, OK, so of course, so you should be familiar with the fact that H and the unitary operator generated by H, they commute when H is time independent, right? So this is U of T. So because of this, I can write this object in this way. Namely, H is H of T when H is time independent. And now let me write what is H. Okay, so now we use the fact that H has that structure. It's a local Hamiltonian. So I will have minus I, the sum over X, then I have U T A phi X U dagger T commutator B. Okay, so now you see we have this commutator. And now we want to use the fact that these are bosonic operators. So unless X as a non-null intersection with A, they would commute. So I can restrict my sum only to those that are, to those axes that I have a non-null intersection with A. So you see, of all the terms in the Hamiltonian that are over all the lattice, the only ones that matter are those that somehow overlap A in some way. So let me define Z1 as the set of axes such that X intersected with A is non-null. So I can simply limit my sum to all those x1s that belong to the z1. So I will write them x1 so that we remember they belong to z1. And then I can pull back the unitary operators inside this commutator and have A of t, phi x of t, commutator B. Now we use, so far so good. Now we use another trick, the Jacobi identity. So here is where I will make some other sign mistakes, probably. Okay. So I will have A of t commutator phi x b, and this is phi x of t, minus phi x of t commutator A of t b. I think the signs are right, but never mind. And you should recognize that this object is f. So you see that we just said that the derivative of f is some linear operator applied on f, because we are commuting f with these objects and we're summing on them. That's some linear operator on f plus some other linear operator. Okay, so I can write all this equation as f prime equal to some linear operator of f plus g. So how do we solve this differential equation, this linear differential equation? So we first find the solution to the homogeneous equation, that is when g is 0. And let me call gamma t is a mapping that gives us the solution to the homogeneous equation. So this is the homogeneous equation. And let gamma t be such that gamma t of phi of 0 is f of t. So of course, because this is L0 is a complicated operator, this gamma t is a very complicated operator as well. And we would be in trouble if I wanted to know in general this. It would be like asking that in general I know the solution to the Schrödinger equation, which I don't. However, I know a very interesting thing about this, which is, what is that we know about this operator? Huh? That it's unitary. And therefore, is norm preserving. So remember that we want to take norms at some point. So this means that the norm of f of t, which is the norm of gamma t f of 0, is also equal to the norm of f of 0. This is because of unitarity. Okay. So this is the solution to the homogeneous equation. The total solution will be like this. So f of t can be written like gamma t that multiplies f of 0 plus the integral. So what is the, I have to pull back this object. And integrate it. Okay. This is just calculus. Okay. So this is the total solution to the inhomogeneous differential equation. And now we see that when I take, so let's start taking some norms. So the norm of f of t, that is the object that I want to bound, I can apply my, so norms obey triangular inequality. So it's smaller than the norm of f of 0 plus the integral between 0 and t of the norm of g of s in ds. And what is g of s in ds? It's this thing. So the norm of g of s is smaller than what? Than, so look at this commutator as the commutator of this object times this object. So this commutator is upper bounded by 2, the norm of this, times the norm of this. Okay? So I can write, I have the sum over the x1s, then I have 2, the norm of a of t, the norm of phi x1 of s, because the variable is s now, b. Okay? Do you agree with this? And also notice that a of t is the unitary evolution of a. So the norm of a of t is the norm of a. So again, we can do this. So far, so good, right? So, and let's plug this object in here. So we can write f of t. So let me put this in a box. So f of t is smaller than the commutator between a and b at time 0 plus the integral between 0 and t of the sum over x1 of 2a times this object. So now we need an upper bound for this object. So let me write it here. So let me call f1 this function, the commutator between phi x1 of s and b. And let me use the same trick than before. Let me take the first derivative. And this will be equal to the sum over all the x's of, so I have some unitary operators, phi x1, phi x, another unitary operator, b. Remember, the sum of x over phi x is the Hamiltonian. So I'm just taking the derivative of this, of phi x1, commutator b. It's exactly the same thing that we did here. OK? But instead of doing it for a, I'm doing it for phi x1. Huh?
Oh, right.
Okay. OK? Of course, there is a minus sign that I'm forgetting. But all these signs that so far I managed to get right, anyway, they will go away. Oh, and now you see that this commutator vanishes unless X has a non-null intersection with X1. So I can restrict my sum to Z2, that is the set of X in our lattice, such that X intersected X1 is different from the null set
with x1 in z1.
So
this is what I mean. Okay? This means I'm restricting my sum to z2. This should be s here. And of course, I can pull back this u's inside. So I can put s here. OK, and now the Jacobi identity again. So we have this. And now we have phi x1 s commutator phi x2 s. So the x became x2 here, right? B minus commutator of phi x2 s commutator phi x1 s b. And again, it has the same structure. This is f1. This is f prime 1. This is f1. So this means that I can write f1 as, so I can bound f1 as what? As f1 of t, of s, sorry. I can upper bound it as the f1 of 0 plus I integrate between 0 and s, and I have s x2, and then I have 2 phi x1 phi x2 of s. Now I'm integrating in s1 b ds1. Where this object is upper bounded by 2 phi x1 b. This is phi x1 of s, but again, it's unitary evolution, so it's just phi x1. Okay? So let's take this object and let's plug it in here. So let me get a new blackboard because I need more space. So we have that f of t is upper bounded by the commutator between a and b plus the integral between 0 and t of 2a. And now we have this stuff, okay, that is. There is a sum over x1. Okay. Sum over x1, 2a. And now, that is the commutator 2 phi x1 b plus the integral between 0 and s of the sum over x2. Then I have 2 phi x1 yeah and the norm of phi x2 s1 b. DS1. Okay. So, and now imagine I iterate this thing many times. Okay, because now I want to find the norm to this. And I can again do the same trick. Okay, and I do it infinite times. So what do I get? So before everything, see that I can always get an upper bound if I substitute all these norms of my operators in the Hamiltonian with k. Because k up there is the max of all the phi x's. So this is brutal, right? It's a brutal upper bound. I'm taking the strongest of all interactions. It's an upper bound. Also, consider a commutator between A and B. So this commutator can be upper bounded in this way, because we know that if A and B do not overlap, so if the distance between A and B is greater than zero, then this commutator is zero. So I could upper bound this number by 2AB times the number of different ways in which they overlap. Okay? So I can just, this is an upper bound. And now, actually, sorry, when I did, so I did something. Here, I should do the same. So instead of upper bounding it in this way, I should know that this is zero if x1 and b have a non-null overlap. Right? So here I can put sigma 1. Is the number of different ways in which x1 and b can overlap, and I am summing over all the possible x1s here. So what the object is the sum of all the possible ways in which x1 and b overlap, summed over all the possible x1s. So what is this? This is the number of paths between A to B. By definition, what is a path? The length of a path is the number of non-intersecting patches that connect A to B, and we are counting with all the possible intermediates that are x1. So let me call this s1. Let me call sigma 1 the number of paths that connect A to B through x1. So we get plus 2AB sigma 1. And then I have this integral that is upper bounded by t. Okay? And we have this object that is k, and we have 2 to the second. Now the next object will be, so let me write it like this. I will get again 2AB, and now I will have the number of paths of length 2 times my integral between 0t and 0s, and now I will have k squared, and I have a 2, another 2, because they nest. So I have this 2 times this 2, and then the other 2 that comes from this one, so I have 2 squared. Okay. And so on and so forth. Is this clear? No? What I'm saying is that this commutator is 0 unless x2 and b have a non-intersecting support. But I'm already assuming that x1 and x2 have a non-intersecting support and all the chain. So I'm counting the paths between a and b with n steps. So all this can be written in this way, like 2ab, And now I have the sum. So I do it infinite times. And what I have is 2 to the n, t to the n, k to the n. Then I have this number sigma n. That's not the sum. It's the number of paths from A to B of length n. Of length n from A to B. Because I only have a non-vanishing commutator if A does not commute with phi x1, and n phi x1 does not commute with phi x2, and phi x3 2 with phi x3, and the last one with B. Okay, so this is a path of length n, and I'm summing over all the possible paths like this. So, but they all have a strength that is k, k to the n, right? Because I am nesting all these. It's a crude upper bound because I'm always getting the worst case scenario, but it's an upper bound. And we should not forget we have all these objects. All these integrations that now are integrating nothing because I've pulled out all the time dependencies, but they're still there, right? You see, at the first order, they gave me a t, that integral. But you see, they are nested integrals. I first integrate in Sn minus 1, then the result. So I think you must have seen somewhere. Anyway, it's called Dyson series. But if you have done quantum field theory or even perturbation, time-dependent perturbation theory, you should have seen this, that integrating nested integrals is like taking 1 over n factorial, integrating everything in T. But now, because we have no integrand, every t gives me an upper bound that is t. So it's t times t times t n times. So what we get here is 2ab. This is a series. Oh, so sorry. I should not have put the t to the n here. The t to the n, it's a little bit. Right there. We have 2 to the n, k to the n. And now we have t to the n that comes from integrating t times. So every time I get the t over n factorial. Times this number Sn. So far, so good. So you see that here there is an exponential that wants to be born, right? But this guy is not of the form something to the n. So let's try to find an upper bound to the number of paths between a to b that is of an exponential form. Okay, now this is a graph theoretic problem because we are just counting number of paths. Okay. So the way we do this, the smart way of doing this is the following. Now let's put in the information of what is the distance between A and B. So let the graph theoretic distance between A and B, let me call it D. Okay? And what is the quantity that I have to confront D with? What do you think? Because here I have a path made of patches, right? So each of these patches has a radius that it is a most R, right? It's written up there. The diameter of X is R. And I have N of them. So I must understand this thing. So with n patches, I can connect two points that are at most at the distance n r, at most, Right, I cannot do more than that. So you see that when D is greater than NR, there are no, this number must be zero. So when D, when my distance is greater of NR, then SN is zero. There are no paths. So this means that I can upper bound, in this case, this number, which is zero, with any number greater than zero. Okay? So this is the first case. The second case is when D is smaller than NR. Now I can bound this number with the total number of paths of length n. So remember, this is the total number of paths of length n that connect A to B. This is a much smaller number than the total number of paths, right? Here I have A, here I have B, and this is a path made of pieces of the Hamiltonian that connects A to B. But I have paths of the same length. I have many of them, many of them, that do not connect A with B. So the total number of paths is greater than the number of paths that connect A to B. So this is smaller than any number C greater than 1 times this S total. You agree? I have also multiplied it for a number greater than 1. Now let's upper bound this. What is a good way to upper bound the total number of paths of length n? So imagine I have a length 1. I have my patch. No? Then I take a second patch. So length 1 means 2 patches. How many paths do I have that intersect? Remember that the maximum volume of these patches is sigma. So there are only at most sigma ways of intersecting. And when I have a path of length 2, there are only at most sigma square ways. So this is smaller than C sigma to the n. And now I must choose a number that is greater than 1 when D is smaller than NR. And I choose C equal E to the alpha NR minus D. So this is greater than 1 for every alpha greater than 0. When NR is greater, N large R, capital R, is larger than D. Oh, by the way, this number, even when NR is smaller than D, is greater than 0. So this is also good, an upper bound for this situation. So this is the upper bound I want. And I will finish, I need really 2 minutes now to finish. So we can write that the norm of the commutator between A of T and B is upper bounded by this P factor times, let's put the pieces together, we have 2 to the n, k to the n, sigma to the n, t to the n over n factorial. We also have this e to the alpha n r times e to the minus t with the alpha. Do you agree? Okay, so let's sum this series. So this is the exponential of 2k sigma e to the alpha r minus alpha d, or which is the same, let me pull out alpha here, in this way. So also remember that this is true for every alpha greater than 0. Right? So for every alpha greater than 0, this is a good upper bound. So I can get the smallest possible alpha, still good, so that I make my bound a little bit tight. So the smallest alpha, the alpha such that minimizes this object, let me call it mu. So this is, I can still write that this is upper bounded by this mu. And for a two-dimensional lattice, this is approximately 2. It's 2 point something. And now we are done. Because now let me define v. Remember, we are in graph theory here, right? So distances are pure numbers, right? The graph distance is just number of steps. So speeds have the dimension of the inverse of time, which is k, energy. So let me call v this number. And so we have here that my commutator is upper bounded by some prefactor, e to the mu vt minus d. Oh, wow, this is a light cone. Vt minus d is a light cone. If d is larger than vt, if the distance between d, a and b, is larger than the time times the speed, my commutator is upper bounded by something that decays exponentially in this distance. So it's not a sharp light cone, but as promised, all signals become evanescent exponentially, just have an exponential tail. If d is smaller than vt, then our upper bound is means nothing, right? Okay, yeah, so they do not commute. All I know is that outside from the light cone, they almost commute. And for all practical purposes, if I get a little bit farther from the light cone, you cannot see it at all. Now, imagine that so this is graph theoretic distance, right? Now, imagine that I embed my graph in real space. So d, let me call a the distance in real space between two consecutive points in my lattice. So d becomes d over a, and d becomes d over a. Do you agree with that? Okay. So this means that I get a here. And you see that in the continuum limit, this becomes sharp, that even if I am a little bit outside the light cone, in the continuum limit, there is no signaling. So the light cone emerges from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. This is a very big result. We don't need to ask relativity to have a light cone. So this opens the question, is the Lorentz symmetry emergent as well? And this is a complicated question. Some people think it is. But the main hint is this. If you have a local structure in the Hamiltonian, then even if in principle it seems that ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics has a signaling, actually you have no signaling. Just in the continuum limit, you have no signal. So tomorrow, you have to believe me that this quantity meant that we could have signaling between A and B. Tomorrow, I'll show you why with this quantity, now we can, and the Lieber-Robinson bounds, we can prove no signaling, we can prove the clustering of correlations and many other things in condensed matter theory. Okay.